Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives, so please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Thursday, April 24th, and we are a few months into the Trump administration, but already we need to be talking about 2026 and not only the congressional races that are very important that are up for election, but the states with gubernatorial elections in 2026, because you may not know that actually 36 states are set to hold gubernatorial elections. That's a lot, and I won't go down the entire list here, but a few, of course, that stand out are California, my former home state of Colorado, my current home state of Florida, also Iowa, Ohio, New York, Tennessee. So some of these, Wisconsin, which is a swing state as well. So these gubernatorial races will have a significant impact on the balance of red versus blue states, regardless of what the federal government is doing. Because remember, we do still live in a constitutional republic, and in the 50 laboratories of democracy, there is a wide difference between what's going on in California versus what's going on here in Florida. And what's going on here in Florida is, quite frankly, a disaster right now in our state legislature because they're trying to marginalize outgoing Governor Ron DeSantis and especially marginalize First Lady Casey DeSantis should she choose to run. Byron Donalds, congressman, has already announced that he is running, endorsed by Trump. And so there's a lot of politics that are going on. And the bottom line, though, for conservatives is that it shouldn't matter whether it's Casey DeSantis or Byron Donalds. What should matter is that the legislature actually works on behalf of the state citizens and on behalf of Floridians and actually get things done. But no, petty politics always takes over. And so we do need to, as conservatives, focus on who is the best primary candidate and who can be the best leader for the future of a lot of these states. And our good friend Steve Dace, who is a Blaze host of the Steve Dace Show and prolific on X, you should follow him there. His home state of Iowa is also having a gubernatorial election, especially because Kim Reynolds has said that she is not going to run for re-election. So what is the state of play here? Steve joins us now. Good morning, Steve. And, you know, some of these races, I think we as conservatives need to be paying a lot closer attention to this, not just talking about the federal level in the Trump administration.
Totally agree, Jenna. I think most of our people have no idea how much redder the country would be If 5 to 10% more spirit-filled Christians voted in primaries nationwide. That's it. I think now to truly get as red as we want to be, it would take more than that. But if something as marginal as 5 to 10% more of spirit-filled Christians voted in primaries, particularly those under the age of 70, particularly those in our age group, Gen Xers now, who are at the peak child-rearing years, earning years now, where your kids are older or moved out, you're an early empty nester. If that group of people in particular, and we won the election last year, I mean, the only age group that Trump won overall was ours, and by a large margin. I mean, we were the whole election. He won us by 11 points last election. So Gen Xers basically saved America in the last election. If 5 to 10% more of spirit-filled Christians, particularly Gen Xers, voted in primaries, the difference of how much redder the country would be palpable. Just that.
And that begs the question, of course, why don't we have more spirit-filled Christians that vote in primaries when we have so many groups that are activist related to turn out the vote, and we encourage Christians constantly to get out and vote our values?
That's a simple question, but the answer sucks. or simple answer, but the answer sucks. The answer is most of us are in churches that preach this. It's not heretical. It's not even heterodoxical. The fundamentals of which you'd hear most Sundays would be correct, but it's a mile wide and an inch deep. There's no application. There's no, you know, much of the New Testament, you know, it's written by, you know, two-thirds of the New Testament is written by a lawyer, okay? And one of the Gospels is written by a scientist. And lawyers love preponderance of the evidence. And so, you know, Paul uses this phrase quite often in the New Testament. If then, or because of, or since, okay? In other words, now that we have explained the philosophical premise here, this is now what is expected of you. And see, that doesn't happen in the vast majority of evangelical churches. People are not offended at hearing you're everyone's a sinner. They're offended at hearing you are a sinner. People are not offended at, you know, Christians are supposed to, you know, serve the kingdom. They're offended at you have to do it. Okay? People aren't offended at the church needs tithes to stay open. They're offended at you need to tithe. And that's what most of these churches that are corporations have cultures like corporations. They don't have elders. They have boards of directors. They don't have creeds. They have mission statements, right? And so they draw crowds by treating people as customers and catering to them as opposed to, you know, catechizing them, discipling them. And so there's no expectation level. Hey, that was a nice message. You walk out of there an hour and a half later, you can't remember a single cotton-picking thing that was said. You know, I mean, I've got nearly a photographic memory. The first church we went to, you've seen the ability to recall the Lord has given me. It's pretty profound, frankly, the stuff I can remember that I didn't even know I knew. I went to the first church we went to after I got saved. We went there for 5 years. I think I can remember two sermons. Okay. I mean, I can remember highlights of college football games I watched 25 years ago. I can remember two sermons. It's just all fluff. It's not meant to grow. It's not meant to plant a root. It's not meant to cause action on purpose, because that would require expectation. That would require a cost, and that would require the people leading the church to actually lead, and not just quote unquote keep growing. So that culture is pervasive everywhere. And you know, I got focused on the family on my show earlier this week to talk about what's going on in your former home state of Colorado, and I thank them for now seeing that they're engaged in that fight. And I told them right on my show, I mean, the sad truth is, frankly, that there is a large swath of churches around the country, all over the country, and in places like Colorado, where now that focus is involved, they will feel like they have permission now to do what the kingdom of God demanded they had done all along. And if they had been doing the heinous demonic legislation of, you know, you're a criminal if you won't acknowledge your kids' pronouns they're doing there, okay, would never have happened. But that's where we are, is we have created an evangelicalism that gives you fire insurance, and then nothing is expected of you. Nothing is. I mean, you now YOLO, thanks Jesus, YOLO. You know, that's much of the missiology that is taught in our churches today.
Yeah, it's unfortunately true. And the church, while it has increased its marketing skills and commercialization and treating its membership a lot more like, you know, gym membership with motivational speeches and TED Talks about how to, you know, get fit with Jesus and all of that, which doesn't actually require personal sacrifice. It doesn't require salvation. It doesn't require a daily seeking the Lord's will and living the Christian life and being engaged. While that is on the rise in the average church in America, then they have abdicated the responsibility of civic engagement that the church should be teaching to a lot of these parachurch organizations like Focus on the Family, like us here at, you know, AFA Action, like a lot of the pro-life groups. Like, I mean, pick your topic, and these organizations, a lot of them that stay in a very specific policy wheelhouse. One of my most frustrating things when I talk to some of these principals of organizations is, well, this isn't really within our wheelhouse. We only focus on these specific issues. And I'm thinking, but these aren't the issues that we need to be focused on right now. And I get it, but then who's focusing on it? What are we doing? And so then you end up with lackluster leadership at best. And you end up with, you mentioned my former home state of Colorado, Steve, that in 2018, because we didn't get enough turnout to vote, we lost the one seat majority in the state Senate, which has now allowed for so much bad legislation through Colorado that it's basically a solidly blue state. And if that happens in the state of Florida, my home state, now, if that happens in your home state of Iowa, then it doesn't really matter what it goes on at the federal level. The state level is closest to us. And imagine, even if, you know, even if Joe Biden were still the president, but we still had solidly red states. I mean, I felt protected here because of Governor DeSantis and that administration.
Sure.
We need to focus more on the state level, and churches need to be focused on their states and preaching and teaching about legislation, that good and bad, and how to vote in churches. But they're not doing that. They're just having potlucks and ladies' teas and, you know, things that are quote unquote ministry that's focused on ourselves. And then these para organizations can only go so far because they have to engage rather than have a membership that is inherent. So going back to your home state of Iowa, though, I mean, what's the playing field there? And how are you planning? I know you've said that you're going to engage significantly in the primary. I plan to here in my home state of Florida. But where are the battle lines?
Yeah, we have a unique situation here because of the organization that my buddy Bob Vanderplas has built here. And it now has it branched out to a few. They're trying to emulate this model of what we've done here in Iowa and many other states. But we have cracked the code here, in that we have that layer of church I just described. We have actually been able to get into many of those churches, and to do so outside of a partisan model, but more of a prophetic one. And in many cases, you'll come to the same conclusion that you know, you and I's conversation is having here. But we have found that we have found ways to mobilize church voters in our state that typically have never taken part in the process before. We have thousands of a network of churches connected here together in our state. So we have a floor here that, frankly, I mean, even if the worst came to worst, much of the conversation about next year's midterms is moot at the general level. But right now, because we have no idea what the economy will be a year from now. I mean, and, you know, people had no idea in 81 or 82 whether Reagan's supply side economics were really going to work. It was a massive paradigm shift. And in that first midterm, Reagan lost 30 House seats. He lost 7 governorships. And he only held on to the Senate because it was such a favorable map. You know, Republicans couldn't lose it, very much like the map the Republicans have next year, too. And it was really later, after that midterm, early mid-83, where the economy suddenly began to take off. And then, you know, you saw what happened in 84. It is very possible that we have something here with, you know, what Trump is trying to do in terms of reassert American leverage in the global marketplace is a paradigm shift. And we have no idea if we'll see fruits of that in 90 days, 9 months, or in 2 years. We don't know. And that will go a long way towards determining what the environment is in the general election in these midterms, you know, 16 months from now. So there's no way of knowing that. And so in the meantime, what we need to be building within our grassroots, within our states, is the kind of bulwark that you are describing. And we have that here in Iowa. Even if we had, you know, the Democrat nominee who's running unopposed, and he's got $10 million in the bank right now, and let's say he were to win, the amount of numbers we would still hold in the legislature because of the on-the-ground strength we have, meaning he pulled enough numbers out of a couple of our urban centers and college towns to get a 52-48 kind of win statewide in a very favorable Democrat environment next year, we would still control so much of the infrastructure on the ground in our state. And at the precinct and legislative level, he would do nothing. He could do nothing to repeal all the work that's been done the last 10 years. He essentially be rendered a lame duck the day that he took office. That's what you should be aiming for in all of your red states. Now, we did this in Iowa, in a state that is not traditionally red. We did this in Iowa, and it didn't happen overnight. You know, it took us about a decade, a little more than a decade, to build that. And so, but if we can do this here, then there is really no reason why it cannot be done in a lot of other states to some degree as well. But Colorado is a cautionary tale. The state to my north, Minnesota, is a cautionary tale that if you let your guard down, if you do not have that infrastructure at work, the kinds of Democrats getting elected today, they're not liberals, they're leftists. You know, I used to say that a liberal is somebody who wants to have government let you do things that God says is dumb and immoral. A leftist is somebody who wants to make you do them. And these people are hardcore Soviets. And they will, about almost a year ago, I went up and spoke to the conservative caucus at the Minnesota State Legislature. And this is a state that even Reagan couldn't win. So, Republicans are used to losing up there. And they were demoralized by what Tim Walz had done. And we were months away from finding out he was going to be a vice presidential nominee. And over again that night, I heard he turned our state into California in one election cycle. I grew up in Michigan. You know, I went to visit there a couple times last year. You can't go anywhere without smelling pot, marijuana, literally nowhere. It's the marijuana capital of America. I mean, Michigan and California are very similar. There's multiple climates. There's multiple landscapes up there. They're both beautiful states. But, you know, Michigan has essentially become California, but with winter. I mean, so the kinds of Democrats now, if you let your guard down, the kinds of Democrats that win now are going to turn you into California overnight. That's what's happened in your former home state. That's what's happened in Minnesota. And that's what will happen to the rest of these states next year. Now, some of this is out of our control. All right. The gambit that Trump is taking with the economy, we can't control whether that is going to pay off in time to change the environment into our favor a year and a half from now. That is outside of our control. So what we should be working on right now, we can't control the meta environment. What we should be trying to control is the local environment, the micro environment of where we live.
And it's so well said. And I think that we can't ignore the fact, Steve, that all of this legislation and this push to legalize marijuana, for example, all of these abortion citizens initiatives and ballot initiatives that have come up in the last cycle, especially since Roe versus Wade was overturned, all of those things then lend to getting out the vote of people who don't want conservative leadership. They don't want moral leadership. And so we can't ignore the fact that a lot of these social issues necessarily have bearing on who we choose to lead our state. Because if Ron DeSantis hadn't been voted in 2018, and we had Andrew Gillum, who was his challenger, and DeSantis won by a very, very narrow margin, I think people don't readily recognize how close Florida would have come and did come to being Colorado.
DeSantis won by less than 1,000 votes. So,
goes to your point that if 5 to 10% of God-fearing Americans in each state would get out in the primaries and the general, then that would have been at least a better margin. But those issues we necessarily have to think through from a biblical worldview. We have to impact and shape society so that we get good conservative leadership. So we're going to have to wrap soon, but last comment.
100%. And ultimately, no matter who we nominate, Democrats are going to call them racist, misogynistic, literally Hitler, xenophobic bigots, coddling a rapist with 34 felony indictments. All right, so the idea of we've got to get the Mitt Romney electable candidate, and no matter who you run, that's who they are. So we might as well get the candidate that can actually articulate our issues well, because they're all getting attacked on our issues. Democrats are going to run on your all Nazis, just like you saw them run in the last election cycle.
Yeah, and that's true even for California as well. I mean, when we're looking at where the Republican base is, it may be that California needs at least, you know, a better Republican, even if they're moderate, better than, you know, a totally leftist Newsom Kamala Harris type. But even in California, I mean, there is a huge opportunity to actually shape that state and go and wind it back and say, let's get back to policies that work. But we have to be very engaged and focused in these races and choose our candidates very wisely in the primary. So Steve, always appreciate your time. You can follow him at Steve Dace on X, and we will be right back with more.
As Christians, how can we even begin to impact others when we live in a culture where truth is relative? It all starts with God's Word. Join us for Activate Summit 2025 at Cadence Bank Conference Center in Tupelo, Mississippi, June 12th through the 14th, 2025. The theme is Biblical Bedrock, building on the authority of Scripture, and it's designed to help you acknowledge the Bible's authority and submit to the clear teaching of Scripture. Hear from Frank Turek.
Evolution describes what does behave, not what ought to behave, right? It doesn't give you oughts, it just gives you what does happen.
Todd Herman.
God always uses evil for good. He's very intentional, and he intentionally chose you to live through times such as these.
And more. The main sessions are for ages 13 and up, while Activate Kids is a separate track for ages 6 through 12. Register for Activate Summit 2025 by visiting activate.afa.net/summit.
Activate Summit 2025.
activate.afa.net/summit.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And the Supreme Court on Tuesday was sympathetic to a group of Maryland parents who want to be able to opt their elementary school age children out of instruction that includes LGBTQ plus themes and content. This coming from SCOTUS blog. The parents argued that the local school board's refusal to give them that choice violates their religious beliefs and therefore their constitutionally protected right to freely exercise their religion. During the nearly 2.5 hours of oral argument, a majority of the justices seemed to agree with them, but several justices questioned whether there would even be any harm to simply allowing the parents to excuse their children from the instruction. This was an amazing exchange between Justice Alito and then also Justice Sotomayor, who, in my opinion, is just such a bully from the bench. You can always tell clearly what advocates she does not agree with, and she doesn't let them finish. But her argument here was that, well, what's the harm of mere exposure to this content? I mean, it would be like saying, you know, what's the harm of just mere exposure to porn? I mean, when you're just looking at porn, what's the harm? I mean, when you're putting LGBTQ content and just showing a same-sex couple to elementary school-aged children and putting this in a positive light and having the instruction and the teaching that you should not disagree with that, you know, what's the harm? So listen to this exchange.
We're not going there.
So Mr. Baxter, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, let me just finish this.
Sure. Point.
So just answer my question. Is looking at the pictures, is there any affidavit from any parent that merely looking at people getting married, holding hands, none of them are even kissing in any of these books, the most they're doing is holding hands, that mere exposure to that is coercion?
Our parents would object to that. They thought.
All right, now, so let's move to what I think your objection is. I think your objection is to the student guidance, correct?
Our objections would be even to reading books that violate our clients' religious beliefs. They've been, their faith teaches, for example, they shouldn't be exposed to information about sex during their years of innocence without being accompanied by moral principles. And here we have both books that violate their moral principles and instruction that tells them that, for example, they can pick their pronouns based on the way they feel, not even just for based on their gender, but how they feel from moment to moment.
Mr. Baxter.
Before we move away from the book that Justice Sotomayor was referring to, Uncle Bobby's Wedding, I've read that book as well as a lot of these other books. Do you think it's fair to say that all that is done in Uncle Bobby's Wedding is to expose children to the fact that there are men who marry other men?
No, Your Honor. And this court in Obergefell promised that parents would be able to continue to teach what this court called decent and honorable beliefs, that same-sex marriage is immoral according to their beliefs. And it's a far stretch from that for schools to compel students to attend. Parents are paying taxes. They have to pay at threat of criminal fines or penalties or the expense of private school. And then to have teachers telling them things that are directly contrary to their
beliefs. The book has a clear message. And a lot of people think it's a good message, and maybe it is a good message, but it's a message that a lot of people who hold on to traditional religious beliefs don't agree with. I don't think anybody can read that and say, well, this is just telling children that there are occasions when men marry other men. Uncle Bobby gets married to his boyfriend, Jamie, and everybody's happy, and everything is, you know, it portrays this. Everyone accepts this, except for the little girl, Chloe, who has reservations about it. But her mother corrects her. No, you shouldn't have any reservations about this. As I said, it has a clear moral message.
Wait a minute. The reservation is about...
Can I finish, please? Yeah. It has a clear moral message, and it may be a good message. It's just a message that a lot of religious people disagree with.
All right, so that was Justice Alito clearly negating Justice Sotomayor's argument. But the fact that she's arguing that just mere exposure, it's not about teaching a message, that mere exposure doesn't violate sincerely held religious beliefs is utterly absurd. But I think it goes even more foundationally to parental rights and the ability of parents to choose the instruction for their children and not have a state-funded institution in a public school, which is what we're talking about here, determine what type of exposure and also content and moral lessons and immoral lessons as well that children, whether it's K through 12, no matter where you are in that grading, not just elementary age, should be exposed to. And this is why school choice matters. This is why parental rights matter. Even in this instance, I think more than the free exercise argument. But let's welcome in Corey DeAngelis, who is a senior fellow at the American Culture Project. And Corey, this is why school choice matters. I mean, I think this case is a seminal instruction to say that if the court didn't hold that parents could opt out, the opting out should take place before they even get to the classroom.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And thanks for having me, Jenna. I think we're going to win this case 7-2. I mean, even Kagan, liberal justice, was having reservations about these books, saying that non-religious parents might even have objections to these books based on their content. And especially religious parents are going to be upset about this gender ideology being shoved down the throats of young children. I mean, even look at Randy Weingarten. She's the president of the teachers union. She was on Fox News, and she had to concede with Martha McCollum that, well, I wouldn't read these books to 4 to 6-year-olds if I was teaching in New York City today. So even the head of the teachers unions admitted that this is some objectionable content that even she would not teach to young children. So parents should at the very least be able to opt out of this curriculum. I mean, the same school district used to allow an opt out. Now they're all of a sudden not allowing parents to do that. I guess they got lobbied by the trans lobby to not allow parents to direct the upbringing of their children. Some of the justices, the liberals, I think Sonia said this, that there would be a lot of chaos if parents could just opt out of things that they disagree with based on their sincerely held religious beliefs. Well, if that's the case, well, that's a great argument for school choice, which Judge Jackson made a great argument for school choice. She said, well, if you don't like what's happening in your public school and all the public schools are doing this, well, you know, it's no biggie. You can just opt out by paying twice, by paying out of pocket to go to a private school or to homeschool your children, which, oh my goodness, talk about a let them eat cake moment, Marie Antoinette moment from Judge Jackson. Easy for her to say. She sent her kids to Georgetown Day School in Washington, D.C. that costs about $60,000 a year, about the cost of Harvard at a K-12 institution. It's easier for her to say just pay twice, but most families can't afford that. And so I think the best solution is to allow the money to follow the child. If you're concerned out of the curriculum in the public schools, I think you should be able to do that. But you should also be able to take it a step further and say the public schools discriminate against religious parents regardless of the curriculum that exists in the Montgomery County public schools, because they can't be religious. And if you want to raise your kid with a religious education, you have no choice in the current system. You're forced to pay $20,000 per year that we spend in taxpayer dollars for the kids in the government schools, and you have no recourse. You have to pay again out of pocket if you want that private religious education. So we do this, Jenna, with special needs kids under the federal IDEA, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. If the district school, the government school, is not meeting your special need, there's a provision in IDEA that says that the district school has to pay for your private school tuition. And so why don't we apply the same logic to religious families, too? They're being discriminated against by the status quo. So I think we're going to win this case, but we can't stop there.
Yeah, so well said. And I agree with you. I think we're going to win this case. I hope that we win it on really solid grounds that will pave the way for future opt-outs. But you're right that parents who are opting out shouldn't be forced to pay twice. And even taxpayers who don't necessarily have, you know, children that they're having to contemplate where to send their children and school choice and so forth, the individual taxpayer and Christians, I mean, if I'm a taxpayer in Maryland, I don't want my tax dollars going to providing this type of content to school children. And that offends my religious belief as well. And so I think there's a lot of work to be done on a wide variety of levels that public instruction like this should not have this type of content that's exposing kids to this type of content when religious taxpayers, and especially parents, but even religious taxpayers can't opt out.
Yeah, I mean, think about Judge Jackson's argument a little further about how it's no problem. All the public schools are doing things that all religious families or a lot of them disagree with, and it violates their rights. What if you said, oh, well, you know, the public schools, they're discriminating based on race, but no biggie, you can pay to go to a private school that doesn't discriminate based on race. That would obviously be a problem. So we should apply that same logic to religious families, too. They should have their rights upheld based on their religious beliefs, just like other protected classes, too. And the good news is, Jenna, that if you live in a red state, and I live in Texas, we just had a big victory, the biggest day one school choice victory in U.S. history. We still have some work to do on the issue, but all families are eligible to apply now for a scholarship of about $10,000, about half of what they spend in the government schools in Texas. That program is going to be up and running next year. And now we have 16 states that have passed universal school choice programs. But the thing is, they're all red states. They're all controlled by Republicans because the Democrat Party is a wholly owned subsidiary of the teachers unions. They're listening to people like Sonia Sotomayor and Judge Jackson. And they've almost haven't learned anything from the November election, where Trump won the parent vote by 9 points. He won with education voters, according to two polls from Atlas Intel before Election Day. And that basically never happens. Republicans usually lose on education historically, but more recently they're making waves. It's a seismic shift to the right. The GOP has emerged as the parents' party, but Democrats are doubling down on authoritarian control over the minds of other people's kids. I think this is the hill they're willing to die on, I guess. I mean, you have Colorado Democrats. They are passing bills for taxpayer-funded abortions. They're passing bills to label you as a child abuser if you, quote-unquote, misgender your child. I mean, it's total it's Orwellian 1984 stuff. You have in Illinois. You even have them coming after for homeschooling, too. It's crazy. But hopefully they learn sooner than later.
Well, and thank you so much, Corey, for the work that you're doing. And this is why we have to be engaged at every level on parental rights and religious freedom. So we will continue to talk about this, and we'll be right back with more. Will you take a moment and celebrate life with me? Last year, Preborn helped to rescue over 67,000 babies from abortion. Hi, this is Jenna Ellis, and I want to thank you for your partnership. Think about what you did. 67,000 babies are taking their first breath now because of you. Your $28 sponsored one ultrasound that was given to a woman as she was deciding about the future of her child. Once she saw her precious baby for the first time and heard their sweet heartbeat, her baby's chance at life doubled. But Preborn's mission is not only to rescue babies' lives, but also to lead women to Christ. Last year, Preborn Network Clinics saw 8,900 women receive salvation. Your help is crucial to continue their life-saving work. Your caring, tax-deductible donation saves lives, so please be generous. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR, or dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Your love can save a life.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, one of the top trending topics right now on X is Congressman Brandon Gill's deportation stance that, according to Grok, says ignites due process debate. All he said is, if you're here illegally, the only process you're due is deportation. Sounds about right. So we have Congressman Brandon Gill joining us now. And Congressman, I think that's absolutely right. And it's very frustrating to see a lot of these overreaching activist judges suggest that the Trump administration has to go on a case by case analysis of whether people who are here illegally, regardless of whether they're the model citizen or they're the most violent criminal, if they're here illegally, that somehow they are stealing a right to due process by virtue of entering illegally. I agree with you.
You know, and the thing is, and thanks for having me on, Jenna, it's always good to be here. You know, we got to put this into context. We got to put this into the context of the past 4 years, whenever Biden and the Democrats flooded our country with tens of millions of illegal aliens who had no process whenever they came in. In fact, at times the administration even facilitated this mass illegal immigration, didn't know who these people were, didn't know what countries they were coming from, didn't know what kind of backgrounds they had, didn't know anything. There was no process, and the American people had no say in it. The entire time, it was an extremely unpopular policy measure from the Biden administration, and the administration told the American people, there's nothing we can do. We got to understand the root causes in foreign countries as to why this is happening. But we need new legislation, or we need, we need to revamp our immigration laws, and there's nothing Biden can do. Now, all of the sudden, Democrats are obsessed with due process whenever it's time to deport these people who came here illegally. They're saying we can't deport them even after a court deportation order because we need a more lengthy process in the case of this Garcia guy from a few days ago. That is so illogical and so contrary to our own legal system. But it also raises the question of if one administration can flood our country with illegal aliens and the next administration cannot deport them. And whenever the Democrats are saying, you know, you've got to have these lengthy court proceedings individually to deport people, they're essentially saying you can't deport them. And we all know that. We know that whenever there are 10 million, 15 million, 20 million people we're trying to deport, if every single one of them has to have a multi-year court hearing, even after we know that they're here illegally, then you're basically just shutting down deportations. That's what the Democrats are doing. But if one Democrat or one president can flood our country with illegal aliens and future presidents cannot deport them, regardless of what the American people want, we don't have a country anymore. And that's where we're at right now. And this is a huge problem that we've got to stand up against.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think that that is the objective of the Democrats, is to simply say that these illegal immigrants are entitled to due process and then clog the system for years and years while they will try to get one of their candidates elected in 2028 to then basically open the floodgates again, like the Biden administration. And then basically once they're here, they can't be removed. And so is there a legislative solution from Congress that could help forestall some of these activist judges from trying to stymie Trump? Or like in your home state of Texas, Governor Abbott, I think, has been very solid in helping the Trump administration and at least enforcing the border in the state of Texas. So does this come down to maybe having some better governors?
I think it's a matter of all of the above. You know, we passed a couple weeks ago the No Rogue Rulings Act, which stops district court judges from issuing nationwide injunctions. I think that that's one excellent step in the right direction. The Senate's got to take up the bill. I filed articles of impeachment against Judge Jeb Boasberg, who demanded that the president turn a plane full of Trinidad Aragua terrorists around as they were being deported and bring them back into the United States. I think that impeachment should be on the table for some of these rogue judges as well. But we've got other tools that we can utilize and that we're looking at right now as well. Congress, of course, has the power of the purse, and we have a lot of authority and oversight authority over lower courts. We can limit their jurisdiction fully. We can abolish them outright. We can defund them. We can make them fund individual rulings. My point in saying this is that there are a lot of different things that we can pursue, and we're looking through all of those right now. Now, one thing that we've been told from some administration officials is that one of the best ways to help them is to just make sure that they've got the funding for deportations. And we can do that via this reconciliation bill that we're working on right now, which will provide at least about $200 billion for border security. It looks like we're still ironing out some of the details. But that will be, I think, the most effective way that Congress can help the president, because deportations cost money. You've got to have planes. You've got to have you've got to have lawyers. You've got to have immigration beds, deportation facilities. You know, there's a lot that goes into that. And right now they need the money. And that's the biggest thing we can do to help them.
And I'm speaking with Congressman Brandon Gill from the great state of Texas. And you're part of the Judiciary Committee, GOP Oversight, House Budget Committee, the DOGE Committee. So, you know, a lot of really important work that's going on. And it seems like you and a handful of others in the Republican conference are standing up firmly saying Congress needs to help the Trump administration achieve the mandate that the voters largely provided to the administration and also to Congress. But is this a conference-wide understanding that this is what you're working toward, or is this just, you know, the handful of the vocal members of Congress? Because I'm not seeing, at least from my perspective, enough of the Republican members that are in lockstep saying, yes, we absolutely need to support mass deportations.
You know, I think that every Republican ran on securing the border and deporting illegal aliens to varying degrees. But every Republican ran on those broad principles. Now it's a matter of actually carrying them out and doing what we told voters we were going to do. And I've been probably on the more aggressive side of the spectrum there. But I think that all Republicans agree. We all know, regardless of how conservative or moderate you are in the Republican conference, that border security is the top priority, or a top priority, for the American people. I think we're all on board with that. We've just got sort of different ideas of how to accomplish that. And like I said, I think that we should be impeaching judges who are clearly usurping their constitutional authority, clearly usurping the president's constitutional authority, who are clearly going beyond their jurisdiction, as Jeb Boasberg did. Not everybody agrees with me on that in particular, but everybody does agree that we should limit their jurisdiction, that we should stop district court judges from issuing nationwide injunctions. I believe every Republican voted for that. So we are all on the same page, broadly speaking. There's a bit of disagreement there. But I think that the Republican conference is pretty unified in saying that we have got to help the president out. That's what the American people elected him to do. That's what they elected us to do. And we've got to follow through. And I think that if we do the things we said we were going to do on the campaign trail, then the midterms are going to go very well for us. If we don't, the midterms are going to be pretty tough for Republicans. I think it really comes down to that.
Yeah, and that will be more discouraging if there is a loss of the majority and not some gains in the Senate for conservatives, because then there's not even an opportunity to provide this type of aid and assistance to the president through this type of legislation, and recontemplating, you know, how Congress constitutionally, because Congress really can do all of these things that you're suggesting that will help narrow the jurisdiction and the overreach of the federal courts. And we don't have these types of opinions like from Boasberg. So you mentioned that, you know, impeachment, really not all of your colleagues agree with that, which I think would be a great solution, because if judges actually recognized the valid threat of impeachment that the Constitution provides the power for, then maybe they wouldn't overreach. But at least some of these other solutions seem like that's absolutely the method and the legislation that needs to happen. And so where are we at with, I mean, you're saying that there's some talks about all of that. Is there current legislation that listeners can support, or where are we at in the posture of congressional aid to the administration?
Yeah, so a couple things there. On the financial aid, that's going to come through the reconciliation bill, which we are marking up in the next couple weeks. So that's coming quickly. The goal is to get the reconciliation bill through the House by Memorial Day, which is a fast timeline, but we're on track to hit it right now. And that's what's going to provide the billions of dollars for the administration to fund deportations, which, again, is the biggest thing that we can do right now. Now, on the issue of reining in the rogue judges, that's something that we're still working through on the Judiciary Committee. And there are a lot of different ideas, and we're starting to put pen to paper on exactly how to legislatively fix that. One idea is to make these judges fund their own individual rulings, which is how it should work. Remember, let's take the case of Jeb Boasberg, for instance, whenever he demanded that plane full of Trinidad and Aragua terrorists turn around midair and come back into the United States. That costs money. You have to pay for the jet fuel to come in, the flight crew to come back into the United States. You have to pay to house all of these terrorists now that they're here, to pay for security. You have to pay for all sorts of things just to fund that restraining order right there. I believe that courts should have to pay for that, or they should have to put up bond to pay for that. That's one, and they should be, but they're not. And that's one avenue that we're discussing going down. But there, like I said, there are several others as well. And we're working through that in conjunction with or right beside the reconciliation bill as fast as we can here in the next few weeks.
That's a really fascinating issue. So, I mean, similarly to a civil case where, you know, then if it's appealed, you'd have to put up bond. And if ultimately Boasberg, for instance, was overturned, then would have to pay for that. And so where would those funds come from under this type of contemplation?
The court would have to issue bond. So they would have to fund themselves. The rulings would have to fund themselves. And that, I think, would go a long ways in pulling back some of the lawfare. If court parties know that these rulings are going to have to be funded on their own, I think that would go a long ways towards to reining in some of these really egregious, over-the-top rulings.
Mm. And it does, and it would, because judges have basically no accountability or consequences other than the potential for being overturned in the future, which, okay, you know, but they don't have any real responsibility or accountability for their rulings. Similarly to overreaching prosecutors, for example, that, you know, even if they prosecute and then they ultimately lose the case on appeal, then it's, oh, well they don't personally have any kind of vested interest in actually being right or following due process or following the law, really, because as the state, they can just use those powers in an overreaching manner and almost never have those types of prosecutorial misconduct lawsuits and, you know, some of those things. And judges are very insulated from that type of accountability, which is why I think a lot of us are fans of impeachment, because that is a mechanism of accountability. But some of these ideas, Congressman Brandon Gill, are really good and really interesting, so that judges can't just fabricate these kinds of rulings and not actually understand what the cost is, not only to policy and to the constitutional overreach and violation of the separation of powers, that kind of thing, but also just practically and financially. And so what are maybe just some other ideas that are being floated around? Because that's the first time I'm hearing of, you know, something like that. So what are maybe some other things that Congress is also contemplating in terms of reining in these activist judges?
Yeah, a couple of things. And that's the key there, is that we have separation of powers, and that the president, as commander in chief of the United States, he and his administration are the ones who are weighing and getting in the weeds of all of these processes that courts don't have jurisdiction over. You know, to take this example again, did Jeb Boasberg know whenever he demanded that plane turn around, did he know the weather conditions in the air at the time? Did he know how much rest the flight crew had? Did he know what the bilateral diplomatic negotiations looked like between the United States and El Salvador at the time? Did he know how much security was ready in the United States to take these terrorists whenever he demanded the plane turn around? The answer to all of those questions is no. He didn't know any of that, and he shouldn't. That's not his authority. He doesn't have jurisdiction over that. That is part of the president's plenary Article 2 constitutional authority as commander in chief. That's part of the separation of powers. And this is where you really start to, I think, understand how egregious these rulings are. Whenever a judge starts to take it upon himself to act as commander in chief, it really is tantamount to a judge demanding that an aircraft carrier turn around on the other side of the globe or dictating troop movements in foreign countries. He doesn't know any of that. That is such an overreach of his authority there. So these are the kinds of things that we're going after. And like I said, we're exploring all of this in the Judiciary Committee. I think, you know, to go off of impeachment, the good thing about impeachment is that we can impeach in the House with a simple majority. Mm-hmm. We're not going to have the votes to remove a judge.
Yeah, so we have other...
make a message in the House.
Absolutely. Well, Congressman Brandon Gill, really appreciate your time. Follow him at Rep. Brandon Gill, and we'll see you tomorrow.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.